Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of mind power. Dignity. What is it? Have we lost it? How do we need to approach that subject? My guest today, Robert W. Fuller, has written a book called All Rise, Somebody's, Nobody's, and the Politics of Dignity. This is such an incredible subject. I want to welcome to the show Robert Fuller. Thank you for being my guest today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Donna.
Robert, you earned a PhD at Princeton University, you've taught at Columbia University, and then you became the president of Oberlin College, which is your alma mater. You have been, for many, many years, the chairman of a global nonprofit, Internews. You decided you were going to get involved with the future of democracy, and you got into doing an analysis of power and the abuse that is at the base of so much of this. This intrigued me, and typically I don't get into politics or to religion, but this isn't about either one of those. This is about something that's so significant that I think it's so good that you have taken the time to do this analysis and to be able to put it into this book, All Rise, so that people can have it in hand and have the opportunity to read it, think about what you present, and have the opportunity to look at what we need to be attentive to, no matter what our positioning in life might be. What got you on this road of investigation?
Well, it began really very early in my life when I observed my classmates suffering from indignity, suffering from humiliation, really, at the hands of teachers and of classmates. I mean, in particular, in second grade, a little girl named Arlene was sent to the hall to spend the entire day out there, exiled, really, banished, because she had dirty fingernails. And this upset me as a young boy, and I didn't come to her defense or anything. I was cowed by this teacher too, but I remembered it my whole life, and it probably was one of the things that drove me into education, because I thought that kind of treatment of students was antithetical to learning, that it would keep them from learning instead of, you know, be part of their education, which I suppose the teacher thought it was. It was the old phrase then was teaching someone a lesson. And that had that punitive, humiliating aspect to it. And that was one way to learn, all right, out of fear. But I thought it was not a good way because it left people so on edge that they put all their energy into defending their dignity rather than into learning.
A very interesting perspective, and I think an astute one relative to various things I myself have experienced. So here you are. These are seeds of thought that have been planted in a very young period of your life. You go through all of the various educational processes. You're a man that becomes involved in various situations, events, I'll use the word environment again, and then you find that there is an agitation that is developing inside of you and that you want to explore this. And I loved how your book started, A Once and Future Nobody.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that nobody positioning, because I've not met many people that would not say that they felt like they were a nobody in one time or another in their life.
Well, that's the key. At one time or another, that's exactly the point. We all will feel like a nobody because we'll be taken for a nobody. Often people are taken for nobodies when they're small. when they're defenseless and weak. And that happens at least twice in everybody's life, at the beginning and at the end. So that's what I meant by a once and future nobody. It's patterned after the famous King Arthur book, A Once and Future King. And everybody at one time or another has that happen to them. So it's an interesting kind of discrimination and abuse. It's a kind that's universal. Unlike racism, for example, which is visited primarily on people with dark skin, or like sexism, which is visited almost entirely upon females. Rankism, in contrast, is something everybody has felt the sting of. Nobodying someone is rankism. It's what somebodies are able to do to nobodies. Not that all somebodies are rankest, just as not all whites are racist and not all men are sexist. But a somebody, that is to say a person of high rank and great power, is at liberty to be rankest in our society still. Rather like when I was a kid, white kids were at liberty to be racist. They could get away with it back in the 40s and 50s. Then something happened. And in the 60s, it became really very difficult to get away with racism. And if you want to be racist nowadays, it'll very likely cost you your job. So something profound has changed. We no longer tolerate abuse and discrimination based on skin color. And my question is, why should we tolerate abuse and discrimination, period? Why do we tolerate somebody's humiliating nobodies, like my second grade teacher did to Arlene, and like I experienced myself actually later in life. When I was a college president, needless to say, nobody picked on me. I was not a victim of any rankism. In fact, had I wanted to, I could have practiced it myself because I was shielded by the position I held. But as soon as I lost my job and title, when I resigned and went another direction, then I became vulnerable to rankism. And that's when I discovered it, and that's when I remembered Arlene.
You have so many different segments in your book, and you made a comment regarding rankism. Nobody land isn't really such a bad place as long as you aren't trying to get out.
Yeah.
Then you talk about how this can take a toll, and there is so much in life that we grow through. And just as you, as a mature man, decided that you needed to take a positioning of bringing what you would like to describe as a dignitarian society, that those are two words that you have in your book, a dignitarian society, and I thought, this is a whole different perspective that gives a flavor of thinking that most people, I don't know that they would know what to do with it. Tell us about your concept of this dignitarian society.
Well, we live in what's probably more or less a libertarian society here in America. Liberty is our primary value. And that's a good thing. Liberty is wonderful. Nobody wants to be without it. Another kind of society is an egalitarian society where everyone's equal. There's no rank. Everyone's declared equal. And in principle, everyone should be paid about the same amount in an egalitarian society. And communism kind of tried a variant of that. I mean, it wasn't really a quasi-egalitarian, but it was much more level than American society. It didn't work, though. Economic productivity fell, and, of course, it was a police state as well, the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
So neither a libertarian or an egalitarian society is quite the answer when it comes to delivering on justice. We have a lot of injustice in the United States still. It takes the form of people being unable to say to go to college, even though they may be plenty smart enough, and yet they lack the tuition, they lack the money to go, and the state doesn't offer enough scholarships for poor people to go to college. So that's a form of educational unfairness or injustice. And a lot of people are trapped in poverty, too, through no fault of their own. So there's, we don't have a liberty and justice for all in the United States. We have liberty, for sure, and we have a measure of equality and a measure of justice, but not as much as would be best. So I've proposed a dignitarian society, which everybody has equal dignity in this, in such a society. And what that means is that everybody has enough liberty and freedom to protect their dignity, and everyone has enough equality so that they don't feel they're a victim of indignity. Everybody has health care and access to higher education and a living wage. But it's not an egalitarian society. It's not socialist or communist. Neither is it strictly libertarian. It's dignitarian. And the fundamental principle is very simple. It's that in a dignitarian society, everyone's dignity is equal. Not their rank, but their dignity. That means that the janitor is treated with respect. The nurse is treated with respect by the doctor. And the patients are treated with respect, and the patients treat the doctor and nurses with respect. In a restaurant, you don't get to treat the waiter or waitress with indignity. Treat them as people doing an important job and bringing you your meal, and you don't stiff them on the tip. That's the only way they make a living. So we learn gradually to treat everyone with equal dignity, even though people will continue to have unequal ranks.
You make a statement, the relationship between rankism and the specific isms targeted by identity politics can be compared to that between cancer and its species. And I found this an interesting comparison. You make your statement, no one realized that lung breath and other organ-specific cancers all had their origins in a similar kind of cellular malfunction. And the familiar isms are subspecies of rankism. And that's where you use racism, sexism, homophobia, other types of prejudice are analogous to organ-specific cancers, and rankism is the blanket malady that's analogous to cancer itself. And
yes.
I thought, that's really getting down to the core level. You found from research, in fact, you put up a website, breakingranks.net, and you were getting thousands of responses from people regarding abuses of power due to rank positioning. In fact, there was something that happened in 2004 with a gentleman who was the director of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center and Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. And he got up in the meeting that you were speaking at, saying this, rankism was a major contributing cause of both shuttle disasters. And he elaborated on that. Would you tell us more about that event?
Well, yeah, that was Dr. Noel Hinners, who was number three at NASA, and actually I had known him in high school. We were classmates, and we were at a meeting together, and I was talking about rankism, how sometimes people of higher rank simply won't listen to people of lower rank and just shut them up and silence them. And that's what happened in the Challenger disaster. A lot of the engineers of lower rank were telling the people who ran NASA not to launch the space shuttle that day. It was too cold. The O-rings would freeze, and it would be dangerous. And they were hushed up. They were shut up. They were not listened to. Now, just because you listen to someone of lower rank doesn't mean you have to do what they say. But it behooves you to listen carefully to everyone on the job, even the janitor. And then a wise CEO will make a final decision, but not by hushing people up. That's rankism to do that. To make the decision is not rankism. It's just a proper exercise of your rank as CEO or as director of NASA in this case. And But I don't think a director of NASA who'd listened to his engineers would have gone ahead with that launch. And that's what Noel Henners was saying. He was spotting that as an example of abuse of the power of the high-ranking officials in that that led to that national disaster, the explosion of the Challenger. And there are many examples of that where someone of high rank just is so full of himself or herself, or thinks that just because they're holding high rank, they must be right, that they stop consulting carefully with all the people who should be their eyes and ears. And then the high-ranking person, yes, the high-ranking person is stuck making the decision, but only after being as well-informed as possible. It turns out the very best CEOs, the ones whose companies are most successful, are really great listeners. And they are humble in that sense of not arrogantly assuming they know best without consulting. So rankism actually does not pay. And treating your employees with dignity does pay. It fosters more productivity and creativity and happiness in the company. And the people who are lucky enough to have a dignitarian boss will be happier and healthier and more loyal to the firm. And this ends up actually paying. Whereas people who are treated in a rankist way become disgruntled and secretly will try and get even by stealing from the company or treating customers badly. So when I speak at a place like Microsoft about the dignitarian company, I tell them they'll actually make more money if they treat their employees with dignity.
You tell a story that I really, really liked in here. You see, rankism begins rankism, so as surely as somebody's visited upon nobody, so too do nobody's inflicted on each other. And you talk about a panhandler who saw a copy of your book that you were carrying and insisted that he was not a nobody. He said, I'm a somebody. But then
right.
he turned around and pointed to another person who was just 50 yards away from him, and this was a woman, and she was pointing to another woman, and she said, see her, now that's a nobody. And your statement was, after you told the story, interpersonal rankism among the rank and file undermines their willingness to cooperate and unite against the most insidious forms of institutional rankism that marginalize them all. So it is knowing human nature, and when we look at history, this has been something that we have had to contend with forever, because there have always been those individuals that say if they're going to go into a position of power, I don't care what positioning they may see that power within, they get there and it's like, I've earned the right to totally destroy everything that's around me because I'm the boss now. I'm God, if you will, and this is it. You have to obey me. And we look at history, we look at the revolutions that have occurred, people that say, I'm going to make a change. You were mentioning Russia earlier. You look at Stalin. People thought that he was going to make a change. He ended up bankrupting the country in 3 years, destroying, you know, creating this horrific police state that was in this process. It wasn't until after his death, and actually not until the 90s, that a lot of this grip was destroyed. And they're starting to recuperate. But you have these things that have gone on repetitively.
Yes.
And
they have. It's almost discouraging. You know, it almost makes you think rankism is human nature and there's no way we'll ever get out of it. But actually, I believe we're on the verge of getting out of it. And we've gotten some practice by figuring out that racism and sexism and the other isms were not good for us, and that our society would not endure if we insisted on those kind of discriminatory practices. And I think America has done a great job in overcoming racism and sexism. We haven't completed the job, but relative to how things were when I was a boy, it's a totally different country.
Yes,
and I think we can do the same thing with regard to rankism, and it's going to take as long. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take decades to do. But people are waking up to it now, and finally there's a name for it now. And having a name is a crucial tool in opposing forms of abuse and discrimination, just like having the name cancer was a crucial tool in curing all the organ-specific forms of malignancy. So now we've got a name, and just like the women's movement, after it coined the word sexism, a lot of good things began happening for women, things like equal pay for equal work, things like control of their reproductive rights. Those kind of things didn't happen until there was that word in the lexicon, the word sexism. Likewise, the word rankism is going to enable nobodies to organize better and oppose anti-dignitarian bosses, cruel, rankist bosses. And there is a lot of activity now against bully bosses. There are several new important books that are saying you don't have to put up with this anymore. You can call your boss a rankist. You can organize affinity groups that discuss rankism and confront a boss who is consistently and chronically humiliating his workers. So I'm optimistic, Donna. I think we're on the verge of turning around thousands of years of rankist history. And it's odd that we should be, but here we are, and I think we have a chance to do it. We've got the vocabulary we need. People are increasingly unwilling to put up with it, especially the young. The young won't work for a rankist boss. They'll just walk. And it's a good thing.
Yes, it is. Now, we've been talking about these components. Let's give a good example of someone that has been able to do this. And I know of a number of business people that have really disliked rankism in their environments. And when they decided to open up their businesses, they said, we're going to do it differently. I mean, you look at the female entrepreneurs. I mean, you have some women that are very dictatorial, too. I mean, this isn't gender specific, which
no, it
very
isn't.
Important. I think it's very important to point that out. You can have arrogance, rudeness, obnoxious behavior of all kinds, regardless of the gender. I mean, that's just a fact. So we're not going to take that to issue there. But John Jacoby, and this was very special to me because I'm here in the Pacific Northwest. But you tell his story. Tell John Jacoby's story and how, long before anybody else had a clue, this man got rid of rankism in his business. Tell us
what was that. What was his business?
John Jacoby with Windermere.
Oh, Windermere, yes. Yes, yes, I do tell the story. I had encountered Windermere through one of the people in the firm and not through John himself, but I heard his story, yeah. Well, that's what he did. You probably know the story even firsthand. Are you in Seattle, Donna?
Yes, I am. I'm just outside of Seattle. So
yeah.
It's there. But his story is such a profound one because he had resigned from a phenomenally successful career in banking.
Yeah.
He had just had it.
Uh-huh. Well, he probably lived a lot longer because he got out from under that chronic rankism. You know, it's there's studies now which show that to live with that kind of humiliation day in and day out is as bad for a person as smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day. It really takes a toll on your health to be a victim of that kind of stress. And I bet this fellow who founded Windermere decided to create a happy and healthy environment and didn't put up with that kind of indignification of either customers or coworkers.
Well, I liked about what he did was that instead, when he started his real estate business, which you point out in your book, he treated his agents as equals, and one, he wanted to make the workspaces attractive. Two, he demanded of them that they conduct themselves with honesty and respect for everybody that they worked with, and he increased their commissions and did not, this blew me away, he did not encourage competition among them.
Yeah.
And he didn't, as his offices grew, he did not encourage competition between the offices. He didn't do that. And today, Windermere is a business that has 250 offices and 7,500 agents throughout the western area of the United States. This man did something that was totally out of context. He wanted his agents to have a very good lifestyle, but he had demands, expectations, which he himself lived. And they walked together. They all knew he was boss. I mean,
yeah.
He set the structure, but he demanded of them that they step up to the mark.
See, it's a perfect example of rank being exercised in a dignitarian fashion and treating everyone with equal dignity. Rank is not the problem, just like gender and race are not a problem. The problem comes in when gender and race are used as an excuse to abuse people of a different gender or race, and the problem with rank only enters when someone of high rank uses the power inherent in that rank to abuse someone of lower rank. And Windermere is a great example of that not happening and the good things that follow when it doesn't happen. And I think there are going to be increasingly more and more entrepreneurs and businessmen and people in other professions who just rule out that kind of behavior in the workplace. Even though, as you said before, people who get to the top sometimes feel they have a right to do unto others what was done to them when they were only halfway to the top or when they were at the bottom. That's a natural human instinct, to do unto others what was done to us. But a better human instinct is to protect others' dignity as we would have them protect ours. It's a kind of a golden rule of dignity. And that's the hallmark of a dignitarian company or a dignitarian church or university or healthcare facility. And I see them spreading, and I would love to see America become the first dignitarian nation in the world. But we're not there yet.
Well, I think that your book, All Rise, Somebody's, Nobody's, and the Politics of Dignity, bring forward some concepts that a lot of people had hoped would take a bigger hold, and I agree with you. I think that there is an expectation. I think with the younger generation, part of our responsibility as mature adults is to be a good example for them, to show them that they have options, that they don't have to do things the old way. And it's going to take courage to break it. It has always taken courage to make
yes.
it.
Yes.
And
it has always
been the wiser elders say to the younger, I'll pass my mantle to you, and it is your responsibility to be a good custodian of it. But we have to realize they've got to do it in their own way, and I think your book, All Rise, gives a wonderful, wonderful opportunity for people to understand that they are somebody. They do have a right and place in this
yeah.
world. They can have respect for themselves, and they can not just earn it from others, but when others do not respect it, they just can't, they don't have to sit there and take it. That they can
no.
stand firm and stand tall.
And everybody really is a somebody, and the sooner we realize that, the better, and stop taking anyone else for a nobody.
Absolutely. All Rise, and Robert's website is breakingranks.net. And I have to tell those of you that are teachers that are listening, business people, this is something that if you are of the mindset where you have seen things evolve and you realize that change is necessary, you realize that there are some things that can be done. If you read Robert's book, you will find teachers that are working with kids, that are developing new procedures and new processes, not to take away individuality, but to encourage it so that it is done in a way that is harmonious, healthy. It can affect the business world. It can affect the whole globe. But it has to start with someone, and it can start with us. The right
yeah.
and privilege of dignity is something we have to feel that we earn, that we have, first of all, that it's our rightful privilege to have. And then we expect it. We're not afraid to earn it, but we respect it in others as well. Sort of the golden rule application, but a different presentation of same. Robert, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Well, thank you for inviting me on, Donna. It was a pleasure.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. Don't go away. Don't forget Robert W. Fuller's book, All Rise, Somebody's, Nobody's, and the Politics of Dignity, his website, breakingranks.net. We're coming back in just a moment. This is Donna Sebo. I've got more good things to share. We'll be right back.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95, plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Hello, this is Dr. Richard Petty, the author of Healing, Meaning, and Purpose, and creator of the RichardGPettyND.com website. I am thrilled and delighted to tell you that starting February 7th, 2008, at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to be joining my friend Donna Sebo on her show on bbsradio.com. We're going to do this every month, and I can guarantee you that we're going to be sharing new information and new concepts that will astonish and inspire you. Hello, this is Dr. Richard Petty, the author of Healing, Meaning, and Purpose, and creator of the RichardGPettyND.com website. I am thrilled and delighted to tell you that starting February 7th, 2008, at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to be joining my friend Donna Sebo on her show on bbsradio.com. We're going to do this every month, and I can guarantee you that we're going to be sharing new information and new concepts that will astonish and inspire you.
Hi, this is Donna, and telephone lines are now open. If you'd like to give me a buzz and let me light up your life with a little bit of insight, here are the telephone numbers you can call in to. 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Also, we have 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222. And all you need to do, if you're a first-time listener, is give me your first name or your initial. Then let me give you my intuitive perceptions, and after that, you can ask me a question about anything that you like. Again, it's painless, doesn't hurt at all. In fact, it's a lot of fun. Gives me a chance to share with you my capacities as an intuitive, and it's always a delight to do that. So again, give me a buzz at 877-876-5227. 888-815-9756 or 530-876-3222. I'm an information resource, and I'm delighted to share it with you. Okay, let's take a look at some information I was going to share with you yesterday, and it's about packing. Yes, so many of us are going to be going on vacation. We have business trips, and for those of us that have traveled a lot on business, usually we're pretty streamlined. We know what we want to take. I always have to chuckle because when my luggage ends up at the airport and the porters lift it, they take one look at me and they say, how can someone so little have something that seems to weigh so much? Well, today when you travel, your maximum for your two approved levels of baggage that you would check in will be only 50 pounds, and most of you know that. 50 pounds is not a lot. And me, when I'm traveling, often I've got books that I'm traveling with because I'm interviewing people, talking with people, even when I'm on the road. So I have this weight that I have to deal with. Well, if you're going on vacation, you're probably not going to be carrying books like I do, and you're going to want to make everything as light as possible. So there are some simple techniques and I didn't have a chance to finish this yesterday when I was doing the show. One of the things that is suggested is you don't want to fold clothes individually as you would in a dresser. If you do, they get creased and crumpled when they're compressed during transit. So get a jump on compression by rolling your clothes. This works very well with pants, shirts, sports shirts. You lay them face down, fold back the sleeves, and then roll from the bottom up. They fit together nicely in the suitcase, and it allows for you to put more items in. Also enables things to keep from shifting, and it protects your clothes from creasing and crumbling. You know, they now have these travel bags that you go ahead and you pack your stuff in them, and then you take the air out. You get to roll them, and they're really pretty neat. So dependent on what you're taking, this is something that you may want to consider to do. They have knit clothes, too, which are a favorite of mine, and knits work beautifully when they are rolled. Also, another option is to fold clothes together. Take two or more items, trousers, for example. Lay half of one pair on top of the other. Fold the one on the bottom over the pair on the top, and then take the other one and fold it on the top. And this gives each pair of slacks some cushioning when you fold it, so it's less likely to crease or wrinkle in the fold. So you need to use your nooks and crannies. I've always been one to put hose inside of shoes, or I'll have maybe batteries or little places that normally are open, your shoes, there may be various items that you carry, and you can just put them all together. It really, really works. I know when we traveled to Russia years ago, things that would go around books or anything that we had, for example, that we're bringing back that we wanted to protect that might be fragile, we wrapped them in our clothes. I know you guys know a lot about this anyway. Jewelry, your computer, all of these things need to, that are easily breakable, anything that you don't want anybody to damage, you need to be able to put it in your carry-on. And I have learned the hard way. If you get the computer, make sure you've got a laptop that weighs only about a pound or two. Unfortunately, those have come out now, because if you're hauling luggage through an airport, even if it's on wheels, when it comes to lifting something up and putting it in the overhead bin, if you're short like me, I've been lucky on most of my trips, there's some good husky guy that can help me lift the bag up and put it up. I just don't have the leverage. I don't have the height. So you just need to be aware that whatever you're carrying when you go on the plane, you want to make sure that you are thoughtful about what you take on, because you're going to be hauling that wherever you go. If you get stuck in an airport like I've gotten stuck in, maybe like 8 hours, that is something you're going to be moving around. And even though luggage is on wheels today, which is such a wonderful thing, it still can be a challenge dependent on what you've got. So just be aware of those little things. Also, some tips that were shared with me is that if you're going to be going someplace where you need bathing suits, pack two of them. And for you guys, many swim trunks can double as shorts. So dependent on what material they're made of and how they're designed, they're easy to pack, and you don't have to worry about them wrinkling. And if you're going someplace warm, you're going to be in them all the time. And one, if they're wet, one pair will dry, and you can wear the other one. Also, pack less. If you know you're the type of person that's going to be picking up a lot of souvenirs, T-shirts, whatever else might be, factor that in. You want to be able to have that with you. I've got friends that'll take one suitcase that's loaded with everything and another suitcase that's empty, so that they can use that for various items when they come back from their trip, wherever they're going. Sometimes people go to a place that's only once in their lifetime they're going to be there, so they want to be sure that they have enough. Also, there are suitcases that expand, and again, we're dealing with weight, and I have learned, because this has been a factor for me, I have learned that there are new materials out now, so you can get a 27 or a 29-inch suitcase where it is just so light. These new space age materials, if you will, that are rugged, they will handle the most unbelievable beatings as they go through the luggage checks, but they are light. So you're not going to have 15 or 20 pounds of suitcase that gives you only 30 pounds available for you to work with. I know, because I've had suitcases that weigh that much. So shop around, check things out. It may behoove you, if you do a lot of travel, to get a piece of luggage that you actually find out the weight of and go with the lighter, pay a little bit more, go with a lighter material, because that'll give you more volume of weight to have working in your favor. A lot of people, they just love to use backpacks, and that's wonderful. It all depends on where you're going. I've had people that have told me about how they've gone to Europe. They have everything in a backpack, and they don't worry about it. But they have chosen clothing that will wash and wear really well. So depending on your needs, what it is that you're going to be doing. If you need fancy clothes, that's not going to work for you. Now, also keep an awareness, like I've just mentioned. When you pack your clothes, you will have an opportunity, if you choose to exercise it, maybe to rinse out some clothes or wash them so that you can wear your outfit more than once. We've got new materials for clothing that are wash and wear, and they look just great. You're not going to have to press them at all. They really travel well. So keep that in mind. If you're going to be gone for 10 days, you may really only need to pack 7 outfits or maybe just 5 outfits. So work with it, and it's going to be a lot more comfortable for you, and you're not going to have all of that extra stuff with you. Now, you can check out on all kinds of things on the web, little clocks, all kinds of stuff that make traveling really a breeze. And in today's world, fortunately, we don't have to be as concerned as our grandparents or parents were about what they wear and to what environment they're going into. But if you're going into other countries, and I mentioned this the other day, become aware of their cultures, their standards, and their customs. Because what might be acceptable in Alaska or the Caribbean may not be acceptable in the Middle East or in certain parts of Africa or Europe. So all of these things we do have to keep in mind when we're traveling, and it does make a difference with what you pack. This is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat today, 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. Also, we have 530-876-3222. Just give me a buzz, and I'll be glad to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. I don't know about you, but it seems like there's an ongoing battle constantly with clutter. It just is amazing to me, especially paper clutter. Well, spring cleaning bug has hit me pretty hard, and I came across some information that I thought was really good, because sometimes with spring cleaning, you need to get into cupboards, you need to get into closets, you need to be able to go through areas that maybe you haven't touched in a few years and say, I think I need to straighten this up a bit. Well, is your underground area, your under sink area in the kitchen something that bugs you? What about under the bathroom sinks? Well, it's easy for those spaces to become cluttered. We just pick something up, we buy something, and we stick it under there. And every once in a while, I have to go through drawers and cupboards and closets to clean stuff out. Well, if you want to tame those spaces that really get cluttered, it's a good thing to do to put a cabinet, for example, underneath your sink. And that way you can, or not a cabinet, the cabinet's already there, but put some shelves in that area that allow you to organize what you've got. And there are lazy Susans with multiple tiers that may enable you to access what you want to access. I have a friend that did that with her kitchen cabinet when it came to spices. She said, I found that I had stuff in drawers, and she got herself this big lazy Susan, adjusted the shelves in her one cabinet, and she spends it. She got one for teas that she liked and also one for her herbs, and it just really made her space more usable. Use tiers. Also, you want to find out ways that you can nest whatever you have, like with pans or baking supplies. All of this is really neat. And then use the inside of the doors of cabinets. They've got all kinds of neat little doodads you can put there where you can put your boxes of maybe your saran wrap or other things that you've got into place, and it keeps it nice and tidy. It's always an ongoing job. It never, never ends. Perfectly organized life? Well, I don't know that we'll ever attain it, but it sure is worth working at it periodically. Makes life a lot easier, I think, when things are a bit organized. This is Donna Siebel. We're going to be taking a break for just a moment. Don't go away. Don't forget those phone lines are open. Give me a buzz, 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. Also, 530-876-3222. We'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Siebel. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com. and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to DTaP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's T-TAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717.
Hi, this is Donna Siebel. I wanted to share some interesting changes that are being accomplished in anthropomorphic training tools. It's all about robots. This fascinates me. People have been talking about doing something like this for so long, and there's been so many different prototypes and models that have been used. One of the biggest challenges when you have students in medicine is how are you going to be able to give them a sense of reality? Let's face it, when you're doing some kind of work, whether you're in the dental area or you're doing surgery or whatever area of medicine you might be in, how are you going to really understand response patterns? It's different when you deal with something that's inert to dealing with a real-life human being, and you find you got all kinds of variables that you're dealing with. Well, Simroid is one of the latest developments. And I've got a picture of it in front of me, and it is incredibly amazing. Now, this particular robot is equipped with a mouth full of feedback sensors. This is for students in the dental area. And this robot is so very carefully structured that if a dental student makes a mistake and reacts or does something incorrectly, this robot immediately gives a response, and it will grimace, it will blink nervously, it'll also yelp in pain. Talk about reality, that's really getting close to it. Now, there's a gag reflex sensor that makes this robot very, very much one that's going to make students alert if the tools go back too far in the mouth, and this was brought to the forefront for the public view in Tokyo at their 2007 International Robot Exhibition. There was a Japanese robotics firm, Kokoro, and they call it their android. And people were just fascinated because this android robot was just so animated and so responsive. I mean, she's absolutely beautiful. And they have, I've got a side picture that shows the teeth and the eyeballs without the face and the hair and everything. It just shows the basic part of it. It's just absolutely amazing. Now, the human-like skin, the muscles, which are air-powered, and the facial expressions, which are so real, contribute, obviously, to the effect. It just made people so excited. Now, they are hoping that this particular robot will be used in classrooms to teach not just dentistry, but also empathy for patients, whether they are metal or they are a real, live, flesh and blood human being. Isn't it awesome? My goodness, we've got so many things that people are evolving into. And why does this happen? It's when we come together with our thinking and our imagination, and we realize that we can make things better than what they are. It is just so very, very important to do that. It's moving beyond parameters that perhaps were established for a long, long time. And I think that that's so great. I love to see it when those people that have got a lot of maturity, a lot of experience, are able to work with individuals that are younger, who have this unlimited imagination. They haven't had to go through certain paradigms of experience, and they are more open and more resourceful. I love the fact that these two worlds are coming together more comfortably, and it is so significant. I was watching a program the other evening on Cars of the Future, and people at MIT, and all the brainstorming that goes on, and how they give the option of design and total freedom at MIT to their students and say, show us what you've got. And some of the big car companies are just amazed at what these young people are thinking up. It is really fascinating. I think that, again, the mature individual that has certain practical experience, we're reaching that point where we're not throwing them out like we've done for so many generations, saying, well, they're old, we don't pay any attention to them. We need to realize that the older individuals have knowledge and understanding that is going to give us a stronger base when we utilize it wisely and well. And they can have a good harmonic. And so that is what I think is evolving here. And it's very, very exciting in my mind's view. Donna Siebel here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. I thought I had heard of just about everything when it came to food, but I hadn't heard about some of these little items. Well, what would you think about paying $5,000 for a hamburger? Do I have to listen for an answer? I don't think so. Well, there is a lot going on in the food world that many of us just haven't a clue about. Do you know that $500 billion worth of food adds up to an unbelievable number of Happy Meals? But do you know the average cost per person at one of the top 10 restaurants in the United States, the average cost per person is $174? Mm-hmm. There's a restaurant in Manhattan, which is a sushi restaurant. They charge $446 for a dinner for one person. And there's a Japanese restaurant in Japan, Aragawa. It serves steaks made with Wagyu beef, which costs about $200 a pound. Now, the reason, and this has been around for a long time, this special beef, the reason this beef is $200 a pound is because they give the cows daily massages, and they also feed them sake. So these cows are really given tender, loving care, and at the time when that meat is served, apparently the beef is so tender, it is just phenomenal. Now, have you ever considered food a collectible? I don't think anybody really had. But apparently, there is a first time for everything, and in 2005, there was a Tokyo pastry chef who baked a 1.65, not $1.65, but $1.65 million cake. Mm-hmm. Well, when I looked at that, I said, okay, how come? It had 200 inedible diamonds on the surface of the cake. Yes, okay. I don't think you'd want anybody to eat that cake. But it was a novelty. Well, this is Donna Siebel. My goodness, we're out of time. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Life is an exquisite experience, and know that you're here to participate in it fully with the best of what you have to offer. We'll be back with you on Monday, same time, same place, right here at bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.